Out in the Bay receives support from Project Open Hand, whose medically tailored food helps Bay Area residents recover from illness, get stronger, and lead healthier lives. Project Open Hand serves people with HIV/AIDS, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and other critical illnesses. Learn more at openhand.org. Welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio and podcast. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, a little trip down memory lane.
Free love was on the menu, my dear. My God.
Meet artist, designer, photographer, and actor Fayette Hauser, co-founder of The Coquettes. That's the late 60s, early 70s theater troupe known for eye-popping costumes, glittery beards, and outrageous makeup and sexy musicals. Her book, The Coquettes, Acid Drag and Sexual Anarchy, inspired a San Francisco Public Library exhibit of the same name. It's up now through August 11th. When I met her there recently, she showed me around and shared some saucy coquette stories.
When you took acid, the first thing you did was take off your clothes.
After we spoke, she read, with relish, one of her essays. But let's start where she did, with what inspired her to create the book.
Well, I've wanted to do this book for quite a while because I feel as if we influenced a great deal of what's going on right now. We created what I like to call a visual language of, it was a more dimensional approach to clothing your body so that what we did did not follow trend or style. We had many influences in the arts world and in the music world. Scrumbly was our musical director, and we had people who were very much into 20s jazz. A lot of us were into the 20s jazz. People collected 78 records, so we had a lot of different music going on at the same time.
Hey, Lottie, how's about a little kiss, huh, honey?
What you gonna give me for it, big boy?
Well, what do you want, baby?
I know what you want. Sorry. Oh, all right. I'll take your heart and your hand and your wallet, too, and your pants and your... You may think I'm your mama from above. I'm just a jaded hussy, honey, and you're a fool in love.
Jaded hussy throughout her life she's been. Jaded hussy. On the street you'll find her, but I ain't fussy until we die.
Jaded
hussy. And we were totally psychedelicized, so we were occupying a different dimension, I like to say. And we decided to dress that dimension in our own surrealistic, abstract, multi-languaged way. And no one had done it before.
So just for someone who doesn't know about the Coquettes, just very briefly, what's the brief description of what the Coquettes were?
Well, we were an experimental theater group that formed in the fall of 1969. And our first performance was New Year's Eve, 69-70, and we were received wholeheartedly by the community because we were really part of the community. We were a big part of the community, and we were channeling the energy of the community, and everybody got it right away, so we were very popular. And then we just devoted our lives to doing the shows once a month at the Palace Theater in North Beach. And then we took it to New York, but we wanted to go to Paris, actually, but we didn't get farther than New York. But then we came back and did more shows, but then everybody wanted to go out on their own. Like, they all had singular ideas. People, you know, we were very individuated through the acid and through a lot of other awarenesses, and definitely by the kind of experience that every show gave you, because we followed a form that was created by John Vaccaro in Manhattan in the underground theater scene. And he would have a theme, he would start a play in a certain way, but then it went wherever it was going to go. And the person who came to us, we were living together, there was a bunch of artists living in a Victorian flat, and we were dressing up all the time. We were very active as artists. And Hibiscus, he had been in theater in New York, and he came here, and he wanted to have a special, like, psychedelic theater. And he had worked with John Vaccaro, so he came to us, and he moved in immediately because he was so fabulous. And he presented us with this idea of doing this kind of theater. And I knew exactly, because I'm from New York, and when I was in high school, I used to go to Lower Manhattan and seek out the avant-garde, so I knew exactly what he was talking about. And so that's what we did.
So, in your book, you describe Hibiscus as your shaman. Why was that?
Hibiscus was a very spiritualized person, and he had an enormous personality. And he was able to express himself with movement and dress, and he just had a huge spiritual energy, and he was so dynamic, and he was from theater. None of us were actors. We were artists in different mediums, but not performance. And Hibiscus was a theater person because he had come from theater. And I mean, he was the only person I've ever met that was really born in a trunk, as they say. He said, theater is the blood in my veins, you know. So he presented us with this idea of a new theater for the new decade, which was experimental, and we would each bring our own individual selves to the stage. And we would have a theme for each show, which we worked out in a scrapbook. And there's photos of it on display here, I think. And so he encouraged us all to have input into what the theater was going to be. And so every show would loosely follow a theme. But everybody, you didn't know what was going to happen. You would get on stage, the show would start, and then it would go wherever. And it was really fun.
Partly because you were all on acid, or most of you?
No, we had already been psychedelicized. So whether or not we took acid for the show was really kind of irrelevant. Because we were already blown, so, you know.
I love that expression.
That didn't matter. Yeah, it was great. I love it.
Now, in shorthand, people talk, you know, they sort of shorthand people say, oh, yeah, Cockettes were this, you know, mostly gay, hippie, drag group. But
no,
so what do you think?
Well, the gay community, there was no, drag meant female impersonation. And that was a subculture. They would play at Finocchio's in North Beach, and they would dress up in, you know, old prom dresses and bad wigs and you know, flump around the stage, and or lip sync or whatever. And it was really, you know, just it was like a joke, actually. And when we came along, and there were, we had one of everything in the group. You know, Link was an Indian. We had three or four African-American members, five women, and, I mean, bisexual. I mean, at that time was the androgyny era. So there was no boundaries to anything at that point, which was fabulous.
You know, it's funny, because I was reading one of the sections earlier, just flipping through the book. That's the first chance I've – the first time I've seen it, by the way, so I've just been flipping through it in the last hour.
I didn't get the
advanced copy. I didn't think fast enough.
It deserved because of the pandemic.
So my question is about you had there's something in here that talks about the sexual fluidity that was going on at the time, and how there was this God body consciousness and sexual self-awareness, and it made me think, like, oh, this is kind of like pre-trans or pre-gender non-binary, right? Where it was like, this is a
those
fluid.
Words weren't even in
the
lexicon.
Words weren't there then, of course, but I mean, the concept was there.
Yes. Well, the concept came about definitely because of the psychedelicization of everyone, because when you took acid, the first thing you did was take off your clothes. And everybody would go to the park because that was a safe place to trip out. You know, you always tried to stay with a group. We would schedule our acid trips and say, okay, we're going to Mount Tam today and we're going to take acid because it's Peter Pan's birthday. And, you know, so it really wasn't something that you did in a solitary way. That was too risky because whatever. Yeah. But it was more fun and definitely better to do it in a group and to be in the park. The park was the mecca, really. And nudity became so common that It was nothing, you know.
So people were walking down Haight Street naked or, you know, nearly or at the time?
Well, by the time I was here, people would be pretty much sitting on the street naked, yeah. But that took a long time. I mean, it was the diggers who chilled out in the 60s when the Summer of Love happened. The government, like, flipped out and were jailing kids and sending them home. It was like this wave, this onslaught they never expected. But it was a movement that had begun, and there was no stopping it. And so the diggers, they were the great activists that made it okay. They talked to the city council, and they said, don't worry about a thing. We'll take care of everything. We'll find housing. We'll feed them. Don't worry about it. Leave it to us. And they did, you know. And the thing was, the Victorians were unoccupied, and they were bulldozing them. So they became squats, or they were owned by people that didn't even live in the city. And so the hippies occupied them, and you could get a flat for $100. So you would have, I don't know how many people, but you would chip in for the rent. But it was very easy to live here and to have that kind of freedom to pursue what you considered your real work. You know, I mean, people who, I mean, this is the problem today, because so many people, young people, are tethered to jobs that they don't like. They don't like their life. And this is when drug damage comes along, because they're so depressed or so confused, because everyone tells them that, look at all these gadgets. You know, all you have to do is work for however many, you know, and you can have all these gadgets, but it's not fulfilling for young people. And I think that's why they turn to so many drugs.
So we probably should get a little bit into the book. How many photographs are in there? Are they mostly yours? It's just like, it's 350 pages and just
356.
Oh, pardon me.
Yes.
Okay.
There's 26 photographers involved. There was, because of the way we looked, that we were so fabulous, there was a lot of photography that was done. And I did a lot of photography myself at the time, and that was really fun, photographing it and then being in the show. I had the camera in the dressing room, and I would roll film, because film was expensive, and then I would jump on stage, and then I would get my camera and go to the front of the stage and take pictures. It was great. I loved it. And I knew all the photographers, because there were opportunities. Sometimes people would ask for photographs for one reason or another, and we would pass around that information so that all of us had the opportunity to spread our work around. So Bud Lee had a major collection, Clay Gerdes had a major collection, and myself. And then other people, Mary Ellen Mark came and shot us, and those were photos. They were for Paris Match, and the photos that were unseen, I went to the archive in New York and saw the contact sheets and was able to choose photos. It was so incredible, because a lot of the pictures in the book no one's ever seen before. So I got a lot of material from obscure things that were shot, and also famous people. Jack Mitchell, he came and shot us when we were in New York, and Bud Lee was a Time Life photographer. Anton Parrish, and just all these different people. So I tried to put as many different people in the book as I could.
All the photos that we see here in the exhibit are, I assume, from the book. Is there like a photo or two or three, either in the book or here, that you would like just like, you know, pick one out and will tell me a story about it?
Okay, well, this person right here.
You're hearing Out in the Bay, Queer Radio and Podcast. I'm Eric Jansen, talking with Fayette Hauser, a founder of the Coquettes. We met in the James Hormel LGBTQIA Center at the SF Public Library, where memorabilia, essays, and photos from Hauser's book, The Coquettes, Acid Drag and Sexual Anarchy, are on display through August 11th. Several photos of individual coquettes are blown up to life size and mounted on human figure cardboard cutouts, as if the coquettes are standing right in front of you.
This is Link Martin, that was his self-created name, was Link Martin. And he was our playwright. He was a writer and a poet. and he had come out of the North Beach Beat Poet community. So he had been in San Francisco for a while, and so he was already far down his path. And he was a Cherokee and an Inuit Indian, and extremely brilliant. And he had the most brilliant abstract mind of anyone I've ever known. And he was already living in the house. It was Scrumbly's flat, and he was the musician. And Scrumbly is very, like, spiritually generous. It just magnetized artists into the house. And so when I moved in, Link was already living there. And so I moved in with two other people, which is Nikki Nichols and Harlow. Mm-hmm. I don't know where her picture is. But we were already into dressing up and going out looking. I mean, the everyday garment that people in San Francisco wore was nothing like what you'd see on the streets of any city. It was already way, way far away from any trend or style of the 70s, which I loved. You know, I was in New York. I love wearing, you know.
Bell bottoms?
Oh, more like, you know, white go-go boots, actually. And, you know, these fabulous little dresses. Anyway, so, but already on the street, people did not dress at all. In the beginning, the original tribe was into a very organic earth color, you know, and suede and the fringe. They created the fringe. The whole look of the hippie women came out of the mushroom community in Mexico. I mean, these people were seekers, and they sought out the mushroom men in Oaxaca, and so they were dressing in, and also the, you know, these skirts, like multicolored skirts, and a lot of jewelry, and also the Victoriana was very popular, because here we are, steeped in the Victoriana, so when if you took acid in this Victorian environment, you saw the art of it and how incredible and detailed it was. So, and a lot of the people, the musicians, were into Western, like Victoriana Western, like the Charlatans. And so that's what I saw when I came here. It was already an alternate scene, like nothing I'd ever seen before, which attracted me tremendously. So I just dove right in. And everybody that was in the group had been here for at least a year. So people were already transformed more into their, you know, individuated persona.
They'd been groomed in some of their areas previously to
groom themselves, really. So Link, I mean, you can see by what he's wearing, it's so abstracted. He has his big picture hat with very large flowers and fruit, probably. And then he has a dress, which is the top is kind of like a ruffled 20s. And the bottom is something that came out of a musical show. Probably we got stuff from the MGM sale, too.
Yes, I saw that. Yeah.
The so the skirt is probably from the MGM sale. And then he's got a purse like your mom would carry, and several scarves hanging from it to give it more visual intensity. We were very much into intensifying the visual experience. So that's why our motto was too much is not enough, you know, because, and in this one article, we were called maximalists, which I thought was like a seriously great title as opposed to minimalism. We were definitely, as you can see in this picture, maximalists. Now that necklace he's wearing, those are lug nuts that he put together in a necklace, and it looks like any kind of fabulous necklace you would see even in a museum. And
talking
it's
talking about the one, the like the choker.
Long one.
Oh, the long one.
Yeah,
okay.
The choker is more like a 50s glamour collar, and then he's got all sorts of pins, and this bracelet on that side he wore all the time, and it was hammered copper masks that was really beautiful. And I think his American Indian Native American influence, he would find things like that. Mm-hmm. And then he has his little shoes. I mean, we were head to toe, mm-hmm. a head to toe creation. Every single item that you put on had a reason to go on you. And we were constantly looking for stuff, too. I mean, there were so many thrift stores, and then, you know, we went to the Church of the Alameda Flea Market every Sunday on acid. And Link was the activist in the group. He was very politically active in very imaginative ways. And Peter Coyote, they used to go to the draft board and create fake, you know, draft cards that would say you were ineligible and hand them out. So Link had his own draft dodge, and he would get a Polaroid camera and a bunch of people and put them in a van and go there. And then the people that were guys that were standing online that were called in or whatever, he would invite them to come into the van and get a job, and they would take a Polaroid of it and say, here, now you take that in there and show them that you're a queer, and they'll let you go. And that's what happened. And
you got a lot of sex that way?
Well, you know, free love was on the menu, my dear. My God.
Since most of her book readings planned for 2020 had been canceled due to COVID, Fayette seemed really happy to read one of her essays in the book for me. It's called Backstage.
Okay. Backstage. Everyone had their own special place, had claimed a space, a piece of mirror, no matter how small, how cracked. Little tables lined the walls under the mirrors. There never seemed to be enough room for the pots of color, bowls of glitter, rags of silk, and feather boas. Feathers were everywhere. Little bright magenta duck feathers were always floating around, finding their way into everything. If you put down a cup of coffee and turned away, there would be a feather floating in it when you turned back. But so what? The boas hung from nails that were right by the door so that you could snatch one up on the way to the stage. Those girls got a workout. Boas would fly from one coming off stage and onto someone going on stage, furiously being whipped and wound around, featuring great attitude. They got easily exhausted, but I loved them when they were ratty. Like bright-colored, shaggy strings, they hung all without obscuring too much of the outfit or makeup. Makeup. What a paltry word for such an elaborate process. Transformational miracle is more like it, but how could you put all that on the top of a tiny pan of color? By the time we got to New York, we desperately needed new makeup, at least I did. Something that would make a big statement but wouldn't explode my face as it had after using watercolors. The paints we used were not meant for the skin, at least not mine. Once I had to go to the ER for a shot of Benadryl when my face blew up like a balloon after a particularly elaborate watercolor facial landscape painting a la Nikki. Some would layer on the paint for a mask-like effect, but the stage lights, as well as the heat of the moment, produced a crack-and-peel effect, something like the surface of an old barn. Not entirely bad, but not always what the elegant queens were trying to achieve. When we got to New York, I ferreted out an old German line of stage makeup that went all the way back to Bernhardt. And Lottie Lania, I might say. Leichner and Sons was listed in the Yellow Pages as having provided elegant and durable stage paste for performers for over 60 years. Perfect. I found them in an old warehouse in Lower Manhattan near the docks. They had palettes of colors arranged in buff-colored rectangular tins, edged with a thin red line, like a paint box, with small pans of the most sophisticated colors that I had ever seen since art school. There was an orange that was the finest color of mandarin, and a cobalt green the color of soft pistachio. These became my favorite staples for the stage and beyond. There was a tin devoted entirely to reds, from dusty rose to bleeding crimson. It was like a thick paint, more like paint than makeup. It was the world of painting and the world of the stage all in one box. These were an immediate hit with the group, and we bought out Leichner's entire stock, including a gold dust so fine that it could turn the skin into antiqued burnished gold with one sweep. The entire day of a show was preparation for that moment in front of the mirror. Everything stopped for me as my face became the canvas. I had gotten beautiful sable brushes, paint brushes. The consistency of the paste was like soft, hot putty that pulled the brush as it swirled into the color. I could feel the soft ground seep into me as I sank into the brush and its color. Pots of bright red glitter, gold and silver sequins, tiny stars, mirrored jewels, all there to amplify these miraculous colors. I watched my face as shapes would emerge straight from my psychic terrain. I would go slowly and there were no boundaries. The result often depended on what part of that terrain was turned on by which drug I had taken. Psychedelics were always a more elaborate look, more intricate. Heroin made it all very sensual. Marshall would stand behind me smoking, watching. Finally, he'd say, "Fayetta, at some point we have to go on stage." Knowing when it was finished was tricky, but eventually I got to the final touch, the eyelashes. These were multi-layered and were like gluing chenille caterpillars over each eye. But by the time I was done, I needed these to tell where my eyes were located. For me, this creation was the real moment, and I needed its protection. Even though I loved it so much, the enormity of the stage experience was overwhelming. I was too vulnerable for it. But this process, these colors, and of course the drag, all got me where I wanted to go, on stage.
Wonderful. You read very well.
Thank you.
Again, you write very well.
And that was Fayette Hauser, reading from her book, The Coquettes, Acid Drag and Sexual Anarchy. We spoke at the San Francisco Public Library, where an exhibit of the same name displays a sampling of the book's photos and essays, and one of Fayette's full costumes. She'll be there in person again at the exhibit's closing party Thursday, August 11th. Find info at sfpl.org/exhibits. That's the San Francisco Public Library's website, sfpl.org/exhibits. You've been listening to Out in the Bay Queer Radio. You can catch up on past episodes, get in touch, and sign up for our email newsletter at outinthebay.org. While you're there, please consider chipping in, won't you? Your donation helps us keep bringing you queer voices and stories. Out in the Bay is nonprofit and independent. We get no financial support from the radio stations that air Out in the Bay weekly, nor from NPR, nor from podcast platforms. We rely on listener support. Just hit the donate button at outinthebay.org. Hey, but here's a way you can help that won't cost you a cent. Please let us know where you are and how you're listening to us. Radio? What station? Podcast? What platform? The information could really help us, so please just shoot us an email at outinthebay@yahoo.com. That's outinthebay@yahoo.com. And by the way, if you're hearing us on KALW, our time might shift from 5 p.m. Friday to 6 p.m. Thursday. Is that better or worse for you? Please let us know with an email to outinthebay@yahoo.com. You can send guest suggestions and comments there too, please. How are we doing? That's outinthebay@yahoo.com. Huge thanks to Brad Payton and Richard Merck of Silicon Valley for their ongoing generous support, and to Susan and Hayward and Keith of Six Pack Foods in Reno, Nevada for their recurring monthly gifts. Join them and us, if you can, please, at outinthebay.org. That's outinthebay.org. We'll thank you on the air, only if you say it's okay. We thank KALW, 91.7 FM in the San Francisco Bay Area, and San Francisco Public Press and its radio station, KSFP, 102.5 FM, for broadcasting Out in the Bay weekly. I got editing help this week from Sydney Fishman. Thank you, Sydney. Our theme music was written and performed by Holly Mead. I'm Eric Jansen. Thank you for joining us. Come back next week, won't you? Out in the Bay at outinthebay.org. Out in the Bay is supported in part by Project Open Hand, providing 2,500 life-saving meals and 200 bags of groceries daily to sustain people experiencing illness, social isolation, or the health challenges of aging. Learn more at openhand.org. Project Open Hand. Meals with love. ¶¶